Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. All right, guys, welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. This is your host, Guy Swan, and we are continuing with yesterday's article, The Use of Knowledge in Society. Again, that is on fee.org, and this is a part two, so we are jumping right into section four of this piece. So if you didn't listen to yesterday's episode, you're probably going to be lost. But it's about what we're talking about here is the nature of knowledge in society and what it means to make use of that knowledge in the economy, and like what the types of knowledge and value they actually have, because we have these very strong misconceptions about what is economically value. We value these overarching scientific theories as the only important knowledge, when there is this ocean of micro knowledge and information that we apply to everyday commerce and like temporal, like very time sensitive, hour-long opportunities that we take advantage of, supply that only certain individuals know about, utilizing people that you can trust or that in your immediate area. All of this information is absolutely critical to organizing society, and it happens thousands of times just in small segments, and the individuals are the ones that know this information. Like, you can't centralize that type of knowledge. It's the vast ocean of this is too large, and it gets larger as the economy gets more connected. So this is the topic and the overarching like concept that we're talking about, and we are digging into Hayek's Use of Knowledge in Society, which is his amazing piece detailing out all of these little nuances and the nature of the problem in just the very notion that we're going to centrally control or design prices or economic allocation of resources. All right. So without further ado, let's go ahead and jump in, starting with part four of The Use of Knowledge in Society. Four. If it is fashionable today to minimize the importance of the knowledge of the particular circumstances of time and place, this is closely connected with the smaller importance which is now attached to change as such. Indeed, there are few points on which the assumptions made, usually only implicitly, by the planners differ from those of their opponents, as much as with regard to the significance and frequency of changes which will make substantial alterations of production plans necessary. Of course, if detailed economic plans could be laid down for fairly long periods in advance and then closely adhered to so that no further economic decisions of importance would be required, the task of drawing up a comprehensive plan governing all economic activity would be much less formidable. It is perhaps worth stressing that economic problems arise always and only in consequence of change. So as long as things continue as before, or at least as they were expected to, there arise no new problems requiring a decision, no need to form a new plan. The belief that changes, or at least day-to-day adjustments, have become less important in modern times implies the contention that economic problems also have become less important. This belief in the decreasing importance of change is, for that reason, usually held by the same people who argue that the importance of economic considerations has been driven into the background by the growing importance of technical knowledge. Is it true that, with the elaborate apparatus of modern production, economic decisions are required only at long intervals, as when a new factory is to be erected or a new process to be introduced? Is it true that once a plant has been built, the rest is all more or less mechanical, determined by the character of the plant and leaving little to be changed in adapting to the ever-changing circumstances of the moment? The fairly widespread belief in the affirmative is not, as far as I can ascertain, borne out by the practical experience of the businessman. It's a competitive industry at any rate, and such an industry alone can serve as a test. The task of keeping costs from rising requires constant struggle, absorbing a great part of the energy of the manager. How easy it is for an inefficient manager to dissipate the differentials in which profitability rests, and that it is possible, with the same technical facilities, to produce with a great variety of costs, are among the commonplaces of business experience which do not seem to be equally familiar in the study of the economist. The very strength of the desire, constantly voiced by producers and engineers, to be allowed to proceed untrammeled by considerations of money costs is eloquent testimony to the extent to which these factors enter into their daily work. One reason why economists are increasingly apt to forget about the constant small changes which make up the whole economic picture is probably their growing preoccupation with statistical aggregates, which show a very much greater stability than the movements of the detail. The comparative stability of the aggregates cannot, however, be accounted for, as the statisticians occasionally seem to be inclined to do, by the, quote, law of large numbers, or the mutual compensation of random changes. The number of elements with which we have to deal is not large enough for such accidental forces to produce stability. The continuous flow of goods and services is maintained by constant, deliberate adjustments, by new dispositions made every day in the light of circumstances not known the day before, by B stepping in at once when A fails to deliver. Even the large and highly mechanized plant keeps going largely because of an environment upon which it can draw for all sorts of unexpected needs: tiles for its roof, stationery for its forms, and all the thousand and one kinds of equipment in which it cannot be self-contained, in which the plans for the operation of the plant require to be readily available in the market. This is perhaps also the point where I should briefly mention the fact that the sort of knowledge with which I have been concerned is knowledge of the kind which by its nature cannot enter into statistics, and therefore cannot be conveyed to any central authority in statistical form. The statistics which such a central authority would have to use would have to be arrived at precisely by abstracting from minor differences between the things, by lumping together, as resources of one kind, items which differ as regards to location, quality, and other particulars, in a way which may be very significant for the specific decision. It follows from this that central planning based on statistical information, by its nature, cannot take direct account of the circumstances of time and place, and that the central planner will have to find some way or other in which the decisions depending on them can be left to the, quote, man on the spot. All right, so that concludes part four. Let's go ahead and just do a little summary and talk about this. So, like, I really like this. This part was really good in particular, and there's one idea that I just love. But this is the idea that an overarching economic plan is completely disregarding the importance of the constant change of society and economic conditions. Like, tomorrow, we do not know what tomorrow is going to be like, and we make adjustments in economic decisions every single time, every single day. We change what's going to happen. I will have plans for tomorrow that get canceled because of something new that I'm aware of, because some person who becomes unavailable, because of some resource that I can't use or some time that I no longer have because something took 2 hours instead of one. Like, arguably, a static economic plan would fall apart after just a decent storm or a flood or any kind of minor change. Like, any attempt at designing some overarching system cannot account for that level of change. It does not allow at all for the fact that everything is under constant flux. There is so much local knowledge and information that must be used in order to determine how to respond to all of these changes, or even to know exactly what the changes are. You can't, those statistics, those overarching aggregates don't give us any insight as to what led us there. And that's a really good point that he talks about, is the statistics themselves are not useful. This is not just some blanket average of randomness. There are deliberate decisions that do you go through your day making just arbitrary bullshit decisions, or do you make legitimate, deliberate choices? Is there a reason that you don't get your car fixed today versus tomorrow, or that you stay in and record the podcast, or that you buy a new computer versus don't? Or do you feel that all the decisions in your life are just arbitrary nonsense, that you're just rolling the dice and seeing what happens? Or do you make real choices? This happens with 300 million people in the country all the time. And none of those valuations, none of those deliberate choices that create, that are, that the statistics are 100% dependent on, are revealed. It's like a hash. It's a one-way function. You can't look at the overarching aggregate and then say, well, these are all the decisions made. Let's break it down into all its immediate pieces and different preferences and time availability and the cost and the expertise of all these individuals. The aggregate is meaningless in that sense. It cannot be used to manipulate, like as information to manipulate the economy. It's the opposite of that. It is a one-way function, just like a hash for all you Bitcoin nerds. Like, it doesn't go the reverse direction. It only tells us something in retrospect. Not only are like the minor and constant changes no less important than they used to be, they're arguably more important today because now we have access to so much information and knowledge at such a speed. And it's the nature of a competitive system that makes this a necessity. If your competitor gets a $10 advantage, you better be trying to make up that decision. I mean, that difference. Like, you need to make deliberate decisions to be the one that gets that $10 advantage faster than the other guy. A stagnant business is a dead business, and the economy is the economist. The mainstream economist today is not accounting for this at all. It's the assumption that we're just going to create this overarching allocation of resources, and all those billions of independent, deliberate, individual choices of our lives are arbitrary. That my choice to not get something done yesterday because there was something more important, something more worth my time, is just irrelevant to their decision of what allocation of resources I get. That's a centrally controlled economy. That's insane, and it's ridiculous. But I loved this. This point was just so, like, that economists dismiss this. He says, like, the entire job and occupation, roughly, this is a summary, obviously, the job and occupation of the manager is to fight with the varying costs and the various means of accomplishing something or responding to some immediate change in the environment. But the economist has just decided that these are just completely uninteresting, and the realities of this just suggest that they're unimportant because it doesn't factor into their aggregates. But this quote was amazing. I just love this. Quote, "The very strength of the desire constantly voiced by producers and engineers to be allowed to proceed untrammeled by considerations of money costs is eloquent testimony to the extent to which these factors enter into their daily work." End quote. Beautiful. Just beautiful. The fact that everybody is bitching about not having enough money is exactly the thing that says those minor economic decisions and trade-offs are so freaking important. That we are constantly, that we feel the burden of those constraints because they're real resource constraints. Money is not an arbitrary tool. It means something real about the economy. Prices mean something real. The fact that everybody is bitching about whether or not we should do something the proper way or the cost-effective way, or that these guys should get paid a living wage or that they should get paid a competitive wage, it's veritable proof of how unbelievably important these micro-adjustments and deliberate economic decisions are every single day in every single one of our lives. And it is outright dismissed by the notion, the very notion of centrally planning resource allocation in an economy, that we're going to give A resources and not B because the aggregate says it's fine if we just put it there. All right, man, that was heated. All right, so let's go back and jump into section 5. I think we can get through another one before I need a break. It's getting a little hot in my Bitcoin blanket fort, but we're gonna keep going. I'm gonna push through. All right. 5. If we can agree that the economic problem of society is mainly one of rapid adaptation to changes in the particular circumstances of time and place, it would seem to follow that the ultimate decisions must be left to the people who are familiar with these circumstances, who know directly of the relevant changes and of the resources immediately available to meet them. We cannot expect that this problem will be solved by first communicating all this knowledge to a central board, which, after interrogating all knowledge, issues its orders. We must solve it by some form of decentralization. But this answers only part of our problem. We need decentralization because only thus can we ensure that the knowledge of the particular circumstances of time and place will be promptly used. But the, quote, man on the spot cannot decide solely on the basis of his limited but intimate knowledge of the facts of his immediate surroundings. There still remains the problem of communicating to him such further information as he needs to fit his decisions into the whole pattern of changes of the larger economic system. How much knowledge does he need to do so successfully? Which of the events which happen beyond the horizon of his immediate knowledge are of relevance to his immediate decision? And how much of them need he know? There's hardly anything that happens anywhere in the world that might not have an effect on the decision he ought to make. But he need not know of these events as such, nor of all their effects. It does not matter for him why at the particular moment more screws of one size than of another are wanted, why paper bags are more readily available than canvas bags, or why skilled labor or particular machine tools have for the moment become more difficult to obtain. All that is significant for him is how much more or less difficult to procure they have become compared with other things with which he is also concerned, or how much more or less urgently wanted are the alternative things he produces or uses. It is always a question of the relative importance of the particular things with which he is concerned, and the causes which alter their relative importance are of no interest to him beyond the effect on those concrete things of his own environment. It is in this connection that what I have called the, quote, economic calculus proper helps us, at least by analogy, to see how this problem can be solved, and in fact is being solved, by the price system. Even the single controlling mind in possession of all the data for some small self-contained economic system would not, every time some small adjustment in the allocation of resources had to be made, go explicitly through all the relations between ends and means which might possibly be affected. It is indeed the great contribution of the pure logic of choice that it has demonstrated conclusively that even such a single mind could solve this kind of problem only by constructing and constantly using rates of equivalence, or, quote, values, or marginal rates of substitution. In other words, by attaching to each kind of scarce resource a numerical index which cannot be derived from any property possessed by that particular thing, but which reflects, or in which is condensed, its significance in the view of the whole means-end structure. In any small change, you will have to consider only these quantitative indices, or values, in which all the relevant information is concentrated, and by adjusting the quantities one by one, he can appropriately rearrange his dispositions without having to solve the whole puzzle from the beginning, or without needing at any stage to survey it at once in all its ramifications. Fundamentally, in a system in which the knowledge of the relevant facts is dispersed among many people, prices can act to coordinate the separate actions of different people in the same way as subjective values help the individual to coordinate the parts of his plan. It is worth contemplating for a moment a very simple and commonplace instance of the action of the price system to see what precisely it accomplishes. Assume that somewhere in the world a new opportunity for the use of some raw material, say tin, has arisen, or that one of the sources of supply of tin has been eliminated. It does not matter for our purpose, and it is very significant that it does not matter which of these two causes has made tin more scarce. All that the users of tin need to know is that some of the tin they use to consume is now more profitably employed elsewhere, and that in consequence, they must economize tin. There is no need for the great majority of them even to know where the more urgent need has arisen, or in favor of what other needs they ought to husband the supply. If only some of them know directly of the new demand and switch resources over to it, and if the people who are aware of the new gap thus created in turn fill it from still other sources, the effect will rapidly spread throughout the whole economic system and influence not only all the uses of tin, but also those of its substitutes and the substitutes of these substitutes, the supply of all the things made of tin and their substitutes, and so on. And all this without the great majority of those instrumental in bringing about these substitutions knowing anything at all about the original cause of these changes. The whole acts as one market, not because any of its members survey the whole field, but because their limited individual fields of vision sufficiently overlap so that through many intermediaries, the relevant information is communicated to all. The mere fact that there is one price for any commodity, or rather that local prices are connected in a manner determined by the cost of transport, etc., brings about the solution which, it is just conceptually possible, might have been arrived at by one single mind possessing all the information which is in fact dispersed among all the people involved in the process. All right, that closes out part 5. I am definitely going to need something to drink, and we will take a break right here, hit our sponsor, and then come right back. All right, so section 5. it gets really hot. I got my tent for open right now. It gets really hot when I'm all intense with like some idea that I really like. But I really love his breakdown of the price system, and there is really nobody that can illustrate it like Hayek can. Well, that's saying something. There's a lot of brilliant economists, and the Austrian school has such fun explorations of the concept. But it really demonstrates the change, how the change in value in scarcity of a good to someone is being communicated without them having to know anything about why. And that's the brilliance of the price system. It's like, you know, anger towards the cost of things or frustration with the costs and restraints is just anger at the fact that the world is scarce, that things are not easy to come by, that physical things actually have to be produced in order to use them, and there's a limited number. Like, I could be angry all day about the cost of a remodel, but clearly, if it doesn't cost me any time or resources, or some other person any time or resources, then I could just have a completely different house just with the click of my finger, you know? Like, but obviously it does. I'm consuming the life, labor, and experiences of someone else to get this work done. And it is exactly the price system that allows me to judge that value against billions of other things that are going on, like so that I can value it against my own time and the other alternative ways that I can spend it, like this podcast and on other work that I'm doing. So like if a hurricane happens in China and diverts some huge supply of wood and raises the cost and then thus the cost of the work to be done to the house, I can readjust the importance of that. Like I can re-decide and make a new economic decision about whether or not I need to get this done right at this very moment. And I don't have to turn on the news. I don't have to know that the whole bunch of wood went to something else. The price system is telling me this. It's scarce for whatever reason. Maybe it's actually because there's some huge project that benefits millions or billions of people rather than just the small number of people in my family who would get to make use of my fresh and much better designed house. But the price system is translating all of that new value and information to me without any of the unimportant details as to where or why that value has shifted, whether it be a massive hurricane where everybody needs to rebuild their houses, or it's some huge project that's going to better the lives of millions and millions of people, and it's consuming all the wood that I would have used to fix my house. So There was actually one of the statements towards the end of this I thought was just really amazing, was that the statement that even if there was a central authority even if we could somehow condense and translate all of this information in an ongoing stream from, like, and it could analyze and evaluate the ocean of, like, just knowledge, individual preferences, all the available means and alternatives, the people who would be best at getting it done, the value and trust of one over the other, the end goals of the billions of people. If even we could somehow condense and translate and make use of all of that information with some single brilliant, artificially intelligent mind, then arguably the best it could do is get close at recreating what is accomplished already by the price system in an uninhibited market. And that's ignoring the fact that the notion of such a thing is basically retarded in the first place. But it just, I love that. That was just a really good quote. Or really good point he made there towards part five. Let's go ahead and jump into part six. How much of this has we got left? We still got part six and seven are long. Okay, we're in for the long haul. I'm still going to see if I can get this done today. And let's go ahead and jump right into part six. Oh, wait, you know, before I forget, we're already way into this, but happy Bitcoin Pizza Day, everybody. It is Bitcoin Pizza Day. How many years ago now? Let me bring it up. If you don't know my crypto economy holiday calendar, what's up? CryptoEconomy.life/calendar. That's not how you spell that. May 22nd, 2010 is Bitcoin Pizza Day. Yeah, that makes sense. This was the first real-world purchase of Bitcoin, or done in Bitcoin, by Laszlo Hanyex. I don't really know how to say his name. But this was the 10,000 Bitcoins for two pizzas. And it's officially the first real-world market price for Bitcoin. So I just wanted to say happy Bitcoin Pizza Day. And tomorrow is actually New York Disagreement Day. We had a couple of them and actually like landed on days like right next to each other. If you want to get those holidays on your calendar, it's all available right there on the website. So if you just go to cryptoeconomy.life/calendar, you can just punch it all in or stuff if you want. But if you like to play around with Lightning and you want to buy the calendar, it will drop you notifications on the day before. Brady Swenson from the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast actually sent me a message the other day, or yesterday, I guess, going like, oh my God, I love my holiday calendar. He showed them the notification of tomorrow is Bitcoin Pizza Day. So if you want to do that, you can always just grab that on the website. It's like $2 in a Lightning payment, which I actually, oh man, I should update that invoice. It's probably like $2.70 or something now with the price of Bitcoin. All right, so let's just go ahead and jump into part six. We must look at the price system as such a mechanism for communicating information if we want to understand its real function, a function which, of course, it fulfills less perfectly as prices grow more rigid. Even when quoted prices have become quite rigid, however, the forces which would operate through changes in price still operate to a considerable extent through changes in the other terms of the contract. The most significant fact about this system is the economy of knowledge with which it operates, or how little the individual participants need to know in order to be able to take the right action. In abbreviated form, by any kind of symbol, only the most essential information is passed on, and passed on only to those concerned. It is more than a metaphor to describe the price system as a kind of machinery for registering change, or a system of telecommunications which enables individual producers to watch merely the movement of a few pointers, as an engineer might watch the hands of a few dials in order to adjust their activities to changes of which they may never know more than is reflected in the price movement. Of course, these adjustments are probably never perfect in the sense in which the economist conceives of them in his equilibrium analysis. But I fear that our theoretical habits of approaching the problem with the assumption of more or less perfect knowledge on the part of almost everyone has made us somewhat blind to the true function of the price mechanism, and led us to apply rather misleading standards in judging its efficiency. The marvel is that in a case like that of a scarcity of one raw material, without an order being issued, without more than perhaps a handful of people knowing the cause, tens of thousands of people whose identity could not be ascertained by months of investigation are made to use the material or its products more sparingly, i.e., they move in the right direction. This is enough of a marvel, even if, in a constantly changing world, not all will hit it off so perfectly that their profit rates will always be maintained at the same constant or, quote, normal level. I have deliberately used the word marvel to shock the reader out of the complacency with which we often take the working of this mechanism for granted. I am convinced that if it were the result of deliberate human design, and if the people guided by the price changes understood that their decisions have significance far beyond their immediate aim, this mechanism would have been acclaimed as one of the greatest triumphs of the human mind. Its misfortune is the double one that it is not the product of human design, and that the people guided by it usually do not know why they are made to do what they do. But those who clamor for, quote, conscious direction, and who cannot believe that anything which has evolved without design, and even without our understanding it, should solve problems which we should not be able to solve consciously, should remember this. The problem is precisely how to extend the span of our utilization of resources beyond the span of the control of any one mind, and therefore how to dispense with the need of conscious control, and how to provide inducements which will make the individuals do the desirable things without anyone having to tell them what to do. The problem which we meet here is by no means peculiar to economics, but arises in connection with nearly all truly social phenomena, with language, and with most of our cultural inheritance, and constitutes really the central theoretical problem of all social science. As Alfred Whitehead has said in another connection, quote, "It is profoundly erroneous truism, repeated by all copybooks and by eminent people when they are making speeches, that we should cultivate the habit of thinking what we are doing. The precise opposite is the case. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them." End quote. This is of profound significance in the social field. We make constant use of formulas, symbols, and rules whose meaning we do not understand, and through the use of which we avail ourselves of the assistance of knowledge which individually we do not possess. We have developed these practices and institutions by building upon habits and institutions which have proved successful in their own sphere, and which have in turn become the foundation of the civilization we have built up. The price system is just one of those formations which man has learned to use, though he is still very far from having learned to make the best use of it, after he had stumbled upon it without understanding it. Through it, not only a division of labor, but also a coordinated utilization of resources based on an equally divided knowledge has become possible. The people who like to deride any suggestion that this may be so usually distort the argument by insinuating that it asserts that by some miracle just that sort of system has spontaneously grown up which is best suited to modern civilization. It is the other way around. Man has been able to develop that division of labor on which our civilization is based because he happened to stumble upon a method which made it possible. Had he not done so, he might still have developed some other altogether different type of civilization, something like the, quote, state of the termite ants, or some altogether unimaginable type. All that we can say is that nobody has yet succeeded in designing an alternative system in which certain features of the existing one can be preserved, which are dear even to those who most violently assail it, such as particularly the extent to which the individual can choose his pursuits and consequently freely use his own knowledge and skill. All right, so he started off this section just talking about how, like, the fact that we have such a marvelous system like the price system does not preclude that the total efficiency or that there is any perfection of the knowledge involved. In fact, perfect is kind of a impossibility in this whole sense, because all the knowledge and preferences and values that are going into this are subjective in the first place. But that the true marvel is that the conditions and changes that occur, even with only one or maybe a handful of individuals, like even knowing about it, that the nature of the scarcity, the nature of the change, will still adjust the actions of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of people in the proper direction. And it adjusts regardless of how many of those people profit properly or make the exact adjustment versus an overshoot or an undershoot of the explicit difference. So it's not that the price is a perfect thing. It's that, like you know, with the Rothbard piece, is that it's all ordinal anyway. It's all in relation to other things. But changes happen so quickly that the price will never actually be truly accurate. It is all, as soon as equilibrium is found, things have already changed. So it's typically out of equilibrium as soon as we've found equilibrium. So it's in the beauty of it is in the fact that the forces are all pushing or pulling in the right direction without any imposed actions or the overarching collection and analysis of the total knowledge with any single entity. And then another really fun thing, like towards the end of this section, was just that I really like the quote he gave, just about the brilliance of like the economic order, the division of labor, and the price system is not that like it enables us to consciously and deliberately do and understand every single thing that is going on, but actually the opposite, that we can disregard so much but still work on accurate knowledge, that we can think less and less about all the things that we've already figured out. Like, because, like, as people, like, in our lives, we have a very limited set of knowledge and memory. We have a very limited number of things that we can understand fully. And we obviously have a very limited amount of time to make use of all this stuff. So it's explicitly because we build on top of institutions that have already succeeded, or advances that we've already accomplished, symbols that we have, we accept certain communication, or we trust or respond to certain things, just like the price system, without having to know or understand the endless amount of intricate detail and decision making, and just understanding everything that is behind those things. But we are still able to make use of them. We're still able to accomplish everything that we can within economic trade, by factoring in all of this knowledge, even though it's not ours. It's someone else's knowledge. It's the knowledge and the scarcity and the nature and the circumstances of all of these other people, but we are acting on it without having to know anything that's happening specifically. And that's the marvel of the economic system. That's the beauty. That's one of the original concepts that just made me go, holy shit, economics is fascinating. Like, it's not this boring math problem that everybody has told me it was up to now. It's this amazing, phenomenal architecture of a thing that we didn't even purposefully design, but just kind of came about from the tools that we started using. And it's just, I don't know, it's just such a fascinating concept. But I'm going too far, too existential, too fast. So let's go ahead and jump into part 7 and close this sucker out. 7. It is in many ways fortunate that the dispute about the indispensability of the price system for any rational calculation in a complex society is now no longer conducted entirely between camps holding different political views. The thesis that without the price system we could not preserve a society based on such extensive division of labor as ours was greeted with a howl of derision when it was first advanced by von Mises 25 years ago. Today, the difficulties which some still find in accepting it are no longer mainly political, and this makes for an atmosphere much more conducive to reasonable discussion. When we find Leon Trotsky arguing that, quote, economic accounting is unthinkable without market relations, end quote. When Professor Oscar Lange promises Professor von Mises a statue in the marble halls of the future Central Planning Board. And when Professor Abba P. Lerner rediscovers Adam Smith and emphasizes that the essential utility of the price system consists in inducing the individual while seeking his own interest to do what is in the general interest, the differences can indeed no longer be ascribed to political prejudice. The remaining dissent seems clearly to be due to purely intellectual and more particularly methodological differences. A recent statement by Professor Joseph Schumpeter in his Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy provides a clear illustration of one of the methodological differences which I have in mind. Its author is preeminent among those economists who approach economic phenomena in the light of a certain branch of positivism. To him, these phenomena accordingly appear as objectively given quantities of commodities impinging directly upon each other, almost, it would seem, without any intervention of human minds. Only against this background can I account for the following, to me startling, pronouncement. Professor Schumpeter argues that the possibility of a rational calculation in the absence of markets for the factors of production follows for the theorist, quote, from the elementary proposition that consumers, in evaluating or demanding consumers' good ipso facto, also evaluate the means of production which enter into the production of these goods, end quote. Taken literally, this statement is simply untrue. The consumers do nothing of the kind. What Professor Schumpeter's ipso facto presumably means is that the valuation of the factors of production is implied in or follows necessarily from the valuation of consumers' goods. But this too is not correct. Implication is a logical relationship which can be meaningfully asserted only of propositions simultaneously present to one and the same mind. It is evident, however, that the values of the factors of production do not depend solely on the valuation of the consumer's goods, but also on the conditions of supply of the various factors of production. Only to a mind to which all these facts were simultaneously known would the answer necessarily follow from the facts given to it. The practical problem, however, arises precisely because these facts are never so given to a single mind, and because, in consequence, it is necessary that in the solution of the problem, knowledge should be used that is dispersed among many people. The problem is thus in no way solved if we can show that all the facts, if they were known to a single mind, as we hypothetically assume them to be given to the observing economist, would uniquely determine the solution. Instead, we must show how a solution is produced by the interactions of people, each of whom possesses only partial knowledge. To assume all the knowledge to be given to a single mind in the same manner in which we assume it to be given to us as the explaining economists is to assume the problem away and to disregard everything that is important and significant in the real world. That an economist of Professor Schumpeter's standing should thus have fallen into a trap which the ambiguity of the term datum sets to the unwary can hardly be explained as a simple error. It suggests rather that there is something fundamentally wrong with an approach which habitually disregards an essential part of the phenomena with which we have to deal, the unavoidable imperfection of man's knowledge and the consequent need for a process by which knowledge is constantly communicated and acquired. Any approach, such as that of much of mathematical economics with its simultaneous equations, which in effect starts from the assumption that people's knowledge corresponds with the objective facts of the situation, systematically leaves out what is our main task to explain. I am far from denying that in our system, equilibrium analysis has a useful function to perform. But when it comes to the point where it misleads some of our leading thinkers into believing that the situation which it describes has direct relevance to the solution of practical problems, it is high time that we remember that it does not deal with the social process at all, and that it is no more than a useful preliminary to the study of the main problem. And there we have it. We have completed the use of knowledge in society by Friedrich Hayek. And this again was on fee.org. That's the Foundation for Economic Education. They have so much stuff like this. And this was just a... this is such an important thing to hit because it's attacking the presumptions of almost all economic positions. It's getting at... there's so many things that are argued in economics or debated about economics that make these assumptions that simply aren't true, particularly about how we can utilize knowledge or what knowledge even means in an economy. And this is such an important thing to hit, and it shows the power and he says the word marvel, like it's truly like a miracle of the price system, like what it can coordinate and how amazing of a tool it is that we have at our disposal that no one participating in it even has to understand how it works. That's what's so crazy. We could all be entirely ignorant and have been for most of human civilization, just completely ignorant as to how and why it works, but it still works. It's still part of our system. And it's just it's an amazing thing that there's this natural pressure towards communicating knowledge in this broad and aggregate way through the constant interactions of partial knowledge, of different valuations, of separate perspectives, of completely unique circumstances. And it is explicitly because of the deliberate and full control of the decisions in those individual situations by those people with the perspectives and who either profit or either benefit or are hurt or harmed by those situations and circumstances. It is because they are the ones making the deliberate trade-off between A or B that the system actually works. And they're using all the information and all the aggregate of all the decisions of everyone else in the determining of what those varying value, those relational values are. And that's just amazing to think that there is this mechanism to push everyone towards understanding and seeing the same state of the world and of reality and of economic, like, efficiency and the use of one, like, alternative over another without anyone. There's no hand moving this thing. There's no single mind that has access to even a significant portion of the information. It's all... so much of it is hidden. It is like how much do you know about what your neighbor, your next-door neighbor does or decides or who they value and who they trust? Like, there is so much going on in the individual person's assessments of what a trade-off is, what I should do today versus tomorrow, and when I should buy something versus an alternative, and all of those different things. In any individual mind, just that alone consumes your life. I mean, that's what life is making those trade-offs, is deciding what to do and finding a purpose. And that all of those things interact together to create this overarching cooperation is just kind of fascinating. And that it's a tool that uses our own self-interest in order to align with everyone else's. It doesn't work against it. It works to align us with the rest of the world, with the end goals and the missions of everyone else in society. By translating their knowledge to us in a simple relation, an ordinal relationship between the value of the thing that I want versus its alternative. That if the world all wants to use tin in something or has some mission for it, and I have some alternative, I simply won't use tin based on its scarcity. I will tend toward using some other good because I don't want to be at odds with the whole world, with the real state of what is scarce and what is in great supply, what is available for me to use and what I have to fight other people to obtain. And the price system does that. And it's just a... It's one of the original ideas that really had me start exploring economics and thinking of it in a wholly different way and thinking of it as a fascinating field of study rather than a boring, just utter boring nonsense, which was kind of my experience of it in school. It was just so dry and And maybe some people still think that. I'm sure some of y'all are like, oh God, we're doing economics again. But I love this stuff, so I'm sorry. I'm a nerd. And we will probably be continuing to hit economics in the future, so get ready. I don't remember what I have lined up for tomorrow, so I'm going to check my huge list and schedule of stuff. Don't forget, happy pizza day to everyone. If you want your own calendar and you have some Lightning Network set up and you want to have some fun playing with it, you can go to cryptoeconomy.life/calendar and you won't miss any of the Bitcoin holidays because I got them all up there. In fact, I should probably start like a GitHub page so that people can submit like new holidays or like corrections and stuff. Why didn't I do that? I should have done that. I will try to remember. Oh, God, put it on my list of crap to do. Let that thing just get 1,000 pages long. Okay. Thank you guys for listening. Do not forget to check out fee.org for the amazing stuff that they make available to everyone. And until next time, thank you so much for listening. Oh, shit. If you want to support the show, please, I've got a donation QR and lightning tip jar and stuff, which you can actually just use on Twitter. I'm on tippin.me if you want to use that. Also, you can actually become a supporter of the show, and I'm going to have some cool goodies and benefits that will come from doing just that, and you can do that right in Anchor. So if you would like to do that, that would be wonderful, and I'm going to make sure that I make it worth your while. We're going to do some fun stuff. This is going to be specific to supporters, so thank you guys if you would do that. Yeah, the other way you can do it is to just share this out. Let everybody you know who wants to hear all the best articles and analysis and commentary, who wants to hear Guy's take on all this stuff, let them know that my podcast is out there. Share it out. And until next time, this is the Cryptoeconomy Podcast. I am Guy Swan. I will talk to you tomorrow. Until then, take it easy, guys. We'll be right back.